Welcome to the Dinner Party Download. This is your icebreaker.
Here's a joke. Horse, rabbi, priest, and a nun walk into a bar. Bartender looks up and says, "What is this? Some kind of joke?"
I'm Rico Galliano.
I'm Brendan Francis Noonan, and from APM American Public Media, this is the Dinner Party Download, the culture show that gives you an edge in your weekend conversations.
You just got a joke from sports writer Tim Wendle that'll help break the ice. His new baseball book, Summer of 68, just came out, and we'll hear more from him later. Also, we speak with actor Julia Stiles. She stars in the new movie, It's a Disaster, and a new web series called Blue.
Plus, we learn about Hell on Earth. Jazz pianist Ben Sidran explains cool cats in small hats. And legendary singer and songwriter Paul Anka doesn't let us put our heads on his shoulder, but he does answer your etiquette questions.
We'll take it. But first, as at any dinner party, we start with small talk. All week long, you've been hearing these headlines.
Former Prime Minister of England, Margaret Thatcher, has died.
U.S. missile defenses are positioned in the Pacific in the event a North Korean missile launch takes place in coming days.
The Senate is moving forward with debate on gun control legislation.
Now for a story you might not have heard. We are speaking with Richard Lawson. He is senior writer at the Atlantic Wire. That is the Atlantic's online arts and culture blog. Richard, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
I'm going to be talking about a coat that hugs you.
Oh.
Wow.
Yeah.
You have one?
This is just like, it's a brand new invention. Some crazy guys at a university in Japan.
Crazy or lonely?
Well, yeah. That's a fine line. So,
okay. All right.
You know.
They're in a university and they're guys, so they're probably both.
Exactly. And they're in the engineering department. So, so they've made a coat that has a belt, some sort of mechanical belt that simulates hugging you. Like, it's a feeling of being hugged from behind.
Whoa.
So you can kind of feel the loving embrace of, well, I mean, these guys say of a girlfriend. The quote is, "The concept of this device is that anyone can get the feeling of having a girlfriend."
Wow.
Oh, man. This is
and,
making
And if
me
you
really
wore this
sad.
Coat, you definitely would not have a girlfriend.
Oh, no. I mean, what if you were with an actual girl and then your coat went off?
That's maybe
yeah. really strange.
Well, it could help. What if you were choking on something? You could ignite
oh,
the coat.
True.
To,
yeah.
It's like a Heimlich coat.
I don't know if they have like tightness settings for it, but you could maybe there's a Heimlich one.
You can tell it was invented in Japan because it's the girlfriend hugging coat, not the mugging coat. Like, do you really want to get hugged from behind?
Right, that's like... what I think is strange. Like, what I would hope that your girlfriend usually hugs you from the front.
So this is the main feature of this. Does it look good? I mean, is it stylish?
It's not. I wouldn't call it stylish. It's very basic. This is just kind of prototype mode. But there is a very cool added value. Let's say you can put on headphones. You can hear phrases such as, "I'm sorry, I'm late," which I guess is like, you know, "I'm sorry, I'm late." But like, if heard the wrong way, girlfriend might become a little more serious.
My word.
Richard Lawson, thanks for
turning the coat into a soap opera.
You're welcome, as always.
And now, time for cocktails.
Once again, we tell you something that happened in history, then give you a fitting drink to serve along with it.
It's our crisp, refreshing history lesson with booze.
First, the history. This week, back in 1827, an Englishman began selling a new invention that changed his countrymen's lives.
No, it wasn't lager. Michelle Philippi tells the story.
Humans first made fire hundreds of thousands of years ago, but we didn't figure out matches till 1827. Oh, there'd been something similar. At the turn of the 19th century, you could buy bits of wood coated with chemicals, which you dipped in sulfuric acid. A few seconds later, the chemicals reacted and made a burst of flame. But these so-called Promethean matches weren't super practical. If the chemicals accidentally combined in your pocket, your clothes might burst into flames. Luckily, a British chemist named John Walker came up with an alternative after mixing some chemicals to make a percussion cap for a gun. The mixture dried on his stirring stick, which he tried to scrape clean by dragging it across a piece of wood. To his surprise, it caught fire. Walker had invented the first friction matches. They still weren't exactly danger-free. Walker's matches sometimes shot sparks several feet across a room, but they were definitely an improvement, and Walker sold them at his pharmacy for 3 years. He named them Congreves, after the British Army's Congreve rocket. Walker wasn't much of a businessman, though. He never patented his invention. So a guy named Samuel Jones swiped the idea. He named his product Lucifers. And they became so famous, some countries still call matches Lucifers today.
So that was the history lesson. Now it's time for the booze. I'm on the line with Alan McPhail. He is the acting manager at the Vane Arms, a bar in Stockton-on-Tees, the birthplace of John Walker. Alan, thanks for joining us.
Hello and welcome from the Vane Arms in Thorpe Hill, Stockton-on-Tees.
And Stockton-on-Tees, so that's Tees is the river nearby your community?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, we're in a kind of industrial area, and the Tees just runs out to the North Sea, and we're just on either side of the river there.
Well, I am speaking to you from Los Angeles on Pacific. And so you heard the history. What drink did it inspire you to make?
We came up with the name Strike.
The Strike.
Yeah, we wanted the cocktail to actually look like a match as well. So we got Bailey's Irish Cream, then okay. We added Kahlua, and then we thought, because it is a match and it is fiery, we wanted to give it a little bit of heat, so we added some brandy as well.
Oh,
so
wow.
That makes up the main stick, if you like, of
okay.
The match.
And this is in a tall glass, like a Tom Collins glass?
It is actually quite strong, so I'm sort of recommending that maybe you have it in a smaller shot
all right.
size glass. So we do have a saying around the bar now, because all the locals have been trying it, and we all say three strikes and you're out. That's the way it's going at the moment.
Wait, so you've been experimenting with some of your locals, and that you've been incinerating their minds with your drink?
That's right, yeah. Mind you don't get burnt.
Well, tell me a little bit about how you got the red part on top. What's on top?
That is grenadine added to a beaten egg white, which also has a little bit of caster sugar added to that as well.
You probably made the drink strong just so you don't have to make a lot of these, because they sound pretty complicated.
Yeah, I mean, you get them out quite quick.
Okay.
So it's been quite fun, actually. It's created a little bit of razzmatazz in the bar.
And then, so we have an amazing photo that we're going to share with our audience on our website, that you put sparklers in there. Now, are these the thing you normally have at the bar?
They're a cake decoration, basically, and yeah. We just clip them to the side of the glass.
Yeah, and they're actually a distant cousin of the match, right? I mean,
of course, yeah. You get the connection.
So, Alan, I think you should go out right now and copyright this cocktail. Don't let history repeat itself.
Hopefully it won't.
Enrico, as mentioned, we have a photo of that drink at our website.
Yeah.
And it really looks like it's in a tall Collins glass, like I said, not a shot glass.
In England, that is a shot glass, I think.
It's just they have bigger appetites.
Yeah. Mm. But ladies and gentlemen, you can judge for yourself. We have also got the recipe for the Strike and all of our previous cocktails at dinnerpartydownload.org.
And now, the guest list, in which an interesting person or persons lists some interesting things.
And our guests are Dave Willis and Casper Kelly. Dave co-created the hugely popular and totally surreal Adult Swim cartoon Aqua Teen Hunger Force. Casper co-created Adult Swim's Stroker and Hoop. They have joined forces on a new show. Here they are to tell us about it and their list.
My name's Dave Willis. I'm one of the writer-creators of the new live-action show for Adult Swim, Your Pretty Face is Going to Hell.
My name's Casper Kelly, co-creator and writer.
Your Pretty Face is Going to Hell is sort of like an office workplace comedy. Our hero, Gary, is sort of a second-class demon as he tries to climb the corporate underworld and impress Satan and do evil deeds, and he's too sweet and goofy and stupid to really succeed at it.
I think his title is Associate Demon.
Yeah, Associate Demon, Incubus in Training.
We're calling this list Hell on Earth, and this is a list of things that are, well, it's pretty self-explanatory, hellish on Earth, I guess.
Number one would be the mural on the inside of the Duomo in Florence. I saw it in Italy last year when we went on vacation. It is as dark and almost as darkly funny as any sort of Far Side cartoon about hell. You know, you always see Jesus depicted on the cross or the baby Jesus with Mary. And on the inside of this dome is just people having their skin flayed. And it's just shocking that this piece of Renaissance art is like as bad as something out of like Itchy the Killer.
And were your kids like, is it okay to see this? Is this okay for us to see? This isn't a museum. Are we allowed to look at this?
Are we allowed to look at this hot poker being inserted into a demon's Oh, no. No, it's not.
Yeah, number two is there's this amazing British Twilight Zone show, Charlie Brooker's Black Mirror. It's really great, and there's an episode where everybody has chips in their head that records their entire life experience, and you can easily just throw it on the TV, so people will obsessively remember things and watch it over and over. Or you can have an argument with your girlfriend. That's not what I said. And then you throw up your memory of what happened, and then she's throwing up her memories.
No, I mean, just...
No, that's brilliant, because sometimes you're a... I didn't mean that. You're a... I'd like you to erase that. You're a... Also, sometimes. You can't just edit off the word sometimes.
That would be hellish.
Well, it would help. It helps for people like me who are... You know, always right. I would finally have a backup.
Yeah, I'm sure that'll be really good for your marriage if you're always right. I'm sure your wife will love that and it will really be healthy.
Number three, I was trying to think of the stuff that influenced the show, and definitely an impactful movie that sort of stayed with me was David Lynch's Lost Highway, most specifically Robert Blake's performance in that.
This is a complicated movie, but in essence, it is about a person who goes through a traumatic event and has a complete mental identity split. But yeah, Robert Blake is just a stranger who appears at a party. And suddenly all the volume of the entire party drops down. And he's looking right at the main character and says,
We've met before, haven't we?
I don't think so. Where was it you think we met?
At your house, don't you remember? As a matter of fact, I'm there right now.
And then the guy's like, what, are you crazy? He's like, no, you don't believe me? Call your house. So he calls his house.
I told you I was here.
Robert Blake as that sort of white-faced demon. It was very unsettling, and we still occasionally joke around the office, call me, I'm in your house right now.
And David Lynch, if you want to direct one of our episodes, if we have a season two, I want to take this opportunity to offer that.
Yes, the offer is wide open. We are non-union. You'll have to do it under a pseudonym, which will kind of alleviate a lot of our PR opportunities in telling people that David Lynch directed an episode. So keep that in mind.
The guest list from Dave Willis and Casper Kelly. Their TV series, Your Pretty Face is Going to Hell, debuts this Thursday at midnight on Adult Swim.
And folks, Brendan and I know all too well about having one's mistakes recorded for instant playback, like in that TV show.
Alas.
Later in the show, we will hear your corrections to our mistakes, in fact.
Also, speaking of hell, in a few minutes, we'll talk with Julia Stiles about her personal inferno.
I hate brunch.
A woman after my own heart.
True.
That and more when the Dinner Party Download continues. Welcome back to the Dinner Party Download, the culture show that helps you win your dinner party. I'm Brendan Francis Noonan.
I'm Rico Galliano. Later, Paul Anka, the man who wrote My Way and a slew of other pop hits, answers your etiquette questions. And in a few minutes, jazz and rock pianist Ben Sidran talks about Hipsters 1.0. But first, it is time to meet our guest of honor.
Yes, and this week it's actor Julia Stiles. Her starring role in the 1999 comedy 10 Things I Hate About You made her a star among the MTV set. Since then, she has appeared in films like Save the Last Dance, The Bourne Identity, and Silver Linings Playbook. Her latest film, It's a Disaster, comes out this week. It's a black comedy about a group of 30-something friends whose regular Sunday brunch is interrupted by relationship issues and the apocalypse.
It's a black comedy.
It's pretty dark.
You were telling the truth.
I spoke with Julia earlier this week, and when I did, I learned that we have something in common.
I hate brunch.
Yeah.
And I particularly hate the idea of couples brunch. My character says that at one point, and that was just because that's how I feel.
Brunch takes up most of your day. If you have one mimosa or Bloody Mary,
then
you're checked out all afternoon.
Exactly.
That eats up the heart of a beautiful day.
I also particularly hate the idea of going to a restaurant for brunch. just like what wait in line.
Oh, man. Yeah, that exactly.
And then get rushed out of there, and it's more stressful than it really is.
You wait in line.
And you do feel like you waste the day. Thank you.
Wow, I'm glad we're aligned on that.
Yeah, we should start a club.
We should have anti-brunch. We could have a breakfast club. Oh, that was already taken. We could have lunch.
Anti-brunch. What would anti-brunch people do?
I think
go for walks.
I think anti-brunch people would have breakfast, and then they would help homeless people. Do something positive.
Yeah. Hear, hear.
Okay, so in this movie, you play a doctor.
Yeah, she's a first responder, but she's irresponsible. She abdicates her responsibilities, deciding not to go out and help people like she should.
She's also searching for an ideal mate. So the other part of this character is that she keeps dating crazy people, right?
Yeah, I'm the perpetual singleton in the group. Everybody else is either married or engaged, and I'm the one who keeps bringing like a revolving door of different guys to each brunch.
Is it harder to prep about what it's like to be a first responder or what it's like to date crazy people?
Danger. The first responder thing, it actually came out of I said to Todd Berger, the director, like, I don't really believe that I could be a doctor. So we decided to make her a bad doctor.
And so the crazy people part?
She's very different from me in that all of her girlfriends make fun of her because she is too picky.
Hmm.
Wait, what does that say about me?
So wait, you're not picky at all?
No.
Wow.
Wait a minute.
I want to know what happened to Brad.
It turned out he was crazy.
Right.
What do you mean, right?
How can every guy you ever date turn out to be?
They just do. I don't know. I really know how to pick them. Are you saying it's me?
I'm just saying. No, what was crazy about him? How was he crazy?
Perfect example. I needed some mouthwash. Mm-hmm. So I'm at his apartment and I open the medicine cabinet and there are giant glass jars of nail clippings and human hair.
Ew. Wait, but it's not his or someone else's.
Does that even matter?
Yeah, it might to the Justice Department.
Another movie you were in recently was Silver Linings Playbook. In it, you play the overbearing sister of Jennifer Lawrence's character. And I wonder if, as an actor, you have any qualms about taking on a prickly character like that.
I had no qualms about taking the part because I was thrilled to be a part of that movie and thrilled to work with David O. Russell and the rest of that cast. And I loved the story. But it did take me a second to get used to playing the sort of comic relief. It was a little bit humiliating at first to be like, oh, God, I'm such an annoying person. And the joke is how gross this girl is.
So humiliating, how so?
It took me a second to stop judging her, or it took me a second to embrace the fact that everyone was going to be laughing at me, not with me.
You do a lot of theater. Mm-hmm. Would that have been easier maybe with a live audience?
Yeah, definitely, because you have no idea. It's sort of like if you were like standing at a mountaintop and trying to yodel or something and the echo never comes back.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely, because the crew's not allowed to make any noise, so you have no idea if you're being funny or not.
So for a certain generation of 20, 30-somethings, there was a time when you were a teen idol, right? Mm-hmm. Fair to say? Movies like 10 Things I Hate About You, Save the Last Dance. When you look back on that, what do you make of the teen fame experience?
Honestly, really, I don't mean to sound earnest, but I'm like really grateful. It afforded me a lot of opportunities in terms of my career and also even just like to pay for college. Mm. Particularly like 10 Things I Hate About You, to be in a movie that 13 years later people remember and still enjoy watching is really remarkable. Like I'm proud of that. I think socially and probably just for my like life, it was a little bit strange. To my life was like radically changed. It's funny though, I don't know if you've ever seen Exit Through the Gift Shop, that movie about Banksy.
Yeah, the movie about the street artist Banksy.
There's a part where at the end where Shepard Fairey talks about how like instant fame is not really a good thing for an artist. Like you need the period of time where you're trying things and failing before people start to pay attention to your work. So part of me thinks like, I don't know what would have happened if I, you know, had worked.
Floundered a little bit earlier.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like I did a little bit of trial and error publicly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so there are a lot of roles that I look back on that I want to do over on, or even just like amazing life events like hosting Saturday Night Live or being on the cover of Rolling Stone, like that stuff I kind of want do-overs on. But, you know,
what?
I'm
you
here.
Did fine.
Thanks. I'm here now, you know,
yeah.
So I'm just in a different phase of life.
All right. Well, we've reached a different phase in this interview. This is the part of the show where we ask our two standard questions. And the first question is, what question are you tired of being asked?
Oh, what is your guilty pleasure?
Hmm.
It's like, why would you want to tell somebody your guilty pleasure if you really feel guilty about it?
Yes. Why do you? Yeah.
And I always feel like the expected answer is something really dumb.
Like something...
Like, what reality TV show do you watch?
Yeah.
And then I feel like a snob if I'm like, I don't really watch reality TV.
You don't?
No,
oh,
I'm...
Excuse me, Ms. Stiles.
I dabble in my occasional dumb... Don't get me wrong. I love a good dumb show.
Okay, so our second question is, tell us something we don't know about you or the world at large. It could be an obscure fact or just an interesting personal fact you haven't shared in interviews before.
Interesting fact. In a woman's lifespan, when she dies, she will have consumed, on average, 10 pounds of lipstick.
Oh, my gosh.
Just from the little bits of licking your lips throughout your life.
Oh, my gosh.
10 pounds lipstick.
Do you use less makeup knowing that?
Yeah,
you don't seem super makeup'd here.
Thank you.
Or I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it doesn't.
Thank you? Question mark.
Your lips look lip colored.
I try to give my face a break because, you know, to have to wear like foundation and all that on a movie set. You know, I try to give my skin a break.
And then you do a lot of stage acting. There's a lot of makeup involved in that
all day long.
So you could be like, we're talking 15, 20 pounds of lipstick consumption.
So gross.
Enrico, now when I hear the phrase put lipstick on a pig,
yeah,
it sounds like a recipe to me.
Yeah. It doesn't so much mean deception. It's just describing the addition of an ingredient to the pig.
Yeah, it means delicious.
I guess.
Glamour bacon.
Bowie's favorite.
Folks, past episodes of our show are naturally beautiful, no makeup required, and you can download them at dinnerpartydownload.org.
To eavesdrop.
Pianist Ben Sidran has played with Eric Clapton, the Rolling Stones, Van Morrison, Diana Ross, and many others. This week he released a new album called Don't Cry for No Hipster. Today we overhear him hep us to the meaning of the term hip.
Hi, this is Ben Sidran. My new record is called Don't Cry for No Hipster, 12 original compositions about the hip experience. Making that record really got me thinking about this whole hipster thing. You know, I first discovered it myself way back, I don't even tell you what the year was, when I was 13 years old. I was living in Wisconsin on the vast tundra, you know, huddled around my little record player like an Inuit next to the fire. And one of those records was called The Hottest New Group in Jazz. It was by Lambert, Hendricks, and Ross. John Hendricks, Dave Lambert, Annie Ross, great singers, great musicians, but the attitude is what really captured me. There was a song called Twisted. Annie Ross, she says, my analyst told me
that I was right out of my head the way he described it. He said I'd be better dead than alive. I didn't listen to his jive.
I loved this anti-authority thing, and it swung. So John Hendricks became my hero. And as I got deeper into the jazz life, I found out that this was only the tip of the iceberg. The entire jazz life was based on this concept of hipness. Now, decades before the term hipster was used to describe young cats in small hats, it was used during the Prohibition years to describe a guy who went into a club with a flask in his hip pocket. So I'm hip meant I'm carrying. So the true hip experience, it's an art of an insider culture. It has rules like any other, only the main difference is that nothing is revealed, especially the rules. Things aren't understood, they're just kind of known. And I learned this from John Hendricks. I finally met John 20 years after I first heard that famous record. I was hired to produce a record for John. So I arrived at Wally Heider's studio. I met with the musicians and the engineer. I arranged all the details, who sits where, what the songs were going to be. And then we're all sitting around waiting for John to arrive. Hour went by. 2.5 hours went by. Suddenly, up the stairs, here comes John Hendricks. He says to me, hey, baby, great to meet you. Say, have you got $100? I got a cab downstairs, and I'm a little short. I give him the money, and he disappears. And he's gone. He's gone for the day. He does not come back. So the next day, I'm early, and John's there. Nobody says anything. Everything's cool. The recording goes along great. So after 3 hours, we take a little lunch break, and John and I are sitting out in the studio talking. He says to me, hey, man, do you know the song Old Folks? I say, no. He says, here, let me show you. And then we walk over to the piano. He starts sketching the melody. I'm picking out the chords. And at one point, he delivers an absolutely masterful vocal. It was like a fountain of profundity opened up right in front of me. I said, John, that's beautiful. We have to record that. And then over the loudspeaker, the engineer says, actually, I did record that. Do you want to hear it? So we listen to it back, and John says, well, that's it. I can never sing it any better than that. That's going on the record. Now, I'm the producer here, and while playing piano, it's possible that I've made a few mistakes. And because the piano has leaked into the vocal track, there's no way to replace it. So I say, John, we got to do it over because obviously I made some mistakes here and blah, blah, blah. And John says, no, I'll never sing it better than that. That's the take. So I decide to pull rank as the producer. I say, John, I think we should record it again. And so John pulls rank as the hipster. He says, man, don't you know that sometimes the mistakes are the only part that's jazz? Case closed. You can hear John's version of Old Folks on his record, Tell Me the Truth.
Everyone knows him as Old Folks.
Producer and pianist Ben Sidran. His new album is called Don't Cry for No Hipster. And you are listening to The Dinner Party Download from American Public Media. Dig.
Just as free as a bird and as good as his word.
And now it's time for the main course, where we talk about our favorite part of a dinner party, the food.
Yeah, who cares about friends and conversation? Brendan, we've talked on the show about the nose-to-tail movement, of course.
Yes, the food trend, not the yoga movement.
That's correct. This is, of course, the idea that if you slaughter an animal, you should eat every part of it from the nose to the tail. Well, this week, I dealt with the tail part, specifically pig's tails. Food writers and chefs more and more are into eating and preparing these things.
Wait, what is there to prepare? Aren't these just pink little coils?
Well, that is one of the things I wanted to figure out. So I spoke to Chef Brian Ng of the LA restaurant, The Spice Table, and I started by asking him why he finds pigtails appealing.
The pig's tail, the beauty of it is it has lean and it has fat and it has skin. It's like having the best spare rib you've ever had combined with like the best pork belly you've ever had.
Really? Because the first thing I would think is that, you know, I think of a curly Q kind of pigtail, that it would be mostly bone and joints.
That's really Wilbur in Charlotte's Web.
You're not cooking Wilbur? That's good. I'm happy.
Yeah, well, I don't know what the name was, but what we have are free-range pigs. So they're very large tails that have significant amount of meat.
Other kinds of pigs will have, you know, like commercially raised pigs have smaller tails?
They do, because they dock them.
Meaning what?
They cut it. They cut it because the pigs are so close together, what they do is they bite each other.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I know. All man is right. And so what they do in free-range pigs, of course, they leave the tail and they don't dock it. They don't cut it. And so it's large.
All right. So I think of spare ribs. I think of, you know, slow grilling, sugary kind of glaze on top of it. Is that how you would do this?
What we do here is we braise it with some fish sauce, garlic, palm sugar, cook it for about 2.5 hours or so, and it almost falls off the bone, right? So it's kind of like if you were to braise a spare rib. What we do next is we take it and we put it on the grill, and then we grill it and you get that nice char and you get that smoky flavor in there. But it is very similar. You would treat it as if you were to treat a rack of ribs.
But again, why not just do a rack of ribs?
Because it's tastier.
Is it? It's really better? You think it's better?
Absolutely, because we're talking about a combination of fat, skin, and lean meat, a cut of spare ribs, right? They're great, and there could be good marbling in there with the fat and the lean. But here you have all of that and you have a nice good amount of fat. And that's great because fat is flavor, right?
But why don't then we see this more often on, you know, every restaurant menu, like spare ribs?
I wish we did, to be honest with you. I think maybe it has to do with social conditioning. You know, a lot of cultures are used to eating the entire pig, right? You kill the pig for the village or your family and you're eating the whole thing. So it's normal. Here in the States, in certain regions, obviously it isn't. I hope to see it more. That means we're utilizing the pig more.
All right. And how common is this in, you know, you do a combination of Singaporean and Vietnamese cooking. Is this a very common ingredient in Asia?
No, it isn't. No, it's one of those things where, you know, you cook the pig, you have one tail. And you have quite a bit of, you know, the leg, the shoulder, the belly. So that's more common.
All right. You want to trot this thing out?
Absolutely.
So here comes, oh, wow. You're right. So it's not curled at all. It's actually, wow,
It's huge, isn't it?
It is. It is a formidable, it's almost a dauntingly formidable slab of meat with a huge layer of fat, it looks like, on top.
And it's pretty phallic, too, which is kind of cool.
Cool is a word. It looks like an inch of fat on top of it. Do I eat the fat or do I peel that off?
So you definitely eat the fat. And the way that we serve it here is we take some green leaf lettuce, some herbs, and we serve it with fish sauce on the side. Pig's tail is very rich. There's a lot of fat, like you said. There's about an inch, inch and a half. What you do is you mix it with the lean, mix it with the skin, put it on the lettuce, put some herbs in there, dip it in the sauce, and you eat it like that. The lettuces and the herbs, it lightens the dish and it balances.
So it's kind of in the same way that you eat a sort of Vietnamese egg roll. You kind of take the egg roll and wrap it in a mint leaf and dip it.
In fact, the inspiration for this dish is a Vietnamese sausage called Nem Nung. And the flavor profiles are all there, and I wanted to integrate that into the pig's tail itself and then serve it in that very traditional Vietnamese way.
All right. You want to hold this microphone for me while I do this?
Just rip right into it.
Oh, wow. It really is falling off a bone. I thought I was going to need a knife, but that is absolutely not necessary. I honestly could eat this with a spoon. This really is not light looking. This looks like a heart attack waiting to happen, but in a good way.
And it's quivering, too. I don't know if it's scared that you're going to eat it, but...
It's a little jello-y.
Yeah, go ahead and put some of the herbs on there as well. So we have mint, and we have red perilla.
What is red perilla?
It's very similar to shiso.
All right, so I'm going to dip this. All right, here we go.
Ah! Do it. There we go.
Oh, ma'am.
So you get the
that is delicious.
You get the crispness from the lettuce. You get the herbs, and then I see you got a nice piece of fat there as well.
A huge dose of fat that is running all over my hand. This is not a gentle dish. I kind of, you know, I think of pigtail, you know, a tail, and it wags. This thing is kicking my butt right now.
And that's a small, non-threatening one. It's actually, it's longer than that. We cut it before we cook it, because if we were to leave the entire tail on, it would be probably about 8 inches long, and it would look like a rat's tail. It's a little freaky, and it would scare a lot of people.
So, Rico, you really got to the bottom of that food trend.
It was a tale that needed to be told, Brendan.
True.
Folks, coming up, we learn about the summer that changed baseball, and singer and songwriter Paul Anka explains his roots his way.
Well, I say I'm a Canadian-American, or an Amicana, or a Canamalcama.
All that and more when the Dinner Party Download continues.
Welcome back to the Dinner Party Download, the show that gives you an edge in your weekend conversations. I'm Rico Galliano.
I'm Brendan Francis Noonan. In a few minutes, we'll learn about the season that changed baseball, and we dig into our email bag to learn some lessons from listeners.
Yes.
But first, it's time for some etiquette.
Yes, each week you send us your questions about how to behave, and here to answer them this week is Paul Anka. For 55 years, he has been singing hits and writing them, like basically all hits ever. You can thank him for the tune Diana, which he made a top 10 smash at age 16. He wrote Buddy Holly's final tune, It Doesn't Matter Anymore. And he wrote She's a Lady, of course, made classic by Tom Jones. His new album came out this week. It's a collection of vocal collaborations called Duets. Here's a clip of him singing My Way with a nobody named Frank Sinatra.
And I planned each charted course, each careful step along life's byway, and more, much more than this, I did it my way.
Not coincidentally, Paul Anka also has an autobiography out this week called My Way, and Paul, it is an honor to have you.
Thank you. It's good to be had.
sounds dirty.
Well, listen, life is dirty nowadays.
But I mean, you
survival of the fittest, I get.
Well, you've more than survived. There, speaking of which, there are probably a million recorded versions of that song.
Yes.
But when you sing it, it is special because you wrote the lyrics. For those who haven't read the book, what do you remember about writing My Way? And did it seem kind of a big deal to you at the time?
Well, it seemed a big deal because it was all predicated on having dinner with Frank Sinatra.
Well, there you go.
Remember him?
Heard of him.
And he said he's quitting show business. He's going to do one more album, and he was out of there. And then he said, kid, you never wrote me that song, because he always used to tease me about writing him a hit. But you have to realize back then, with my hits, Puppy Love and Lonely Boy. If I ever gave him one of those, he would have thrown me out of a window.
Why would he have thrown you out of a window?
He didn't like pop music. He hated it. Hated Presley. Hated everything. It was all in the American Songbook, which is cool.
But was he jealous of you, do you think?
I don't think so. No.
Frank wasn't jealous of
Frank
anyone.
Wasn't. Maybe because I had a lot of hair, but that was about it. But at that point, I went home back to New York where I was living, and I said, wow, he's quitting. So 1 o'clock in the morning, I'm sitting at my typewriter, and metaphorically, I just started with, and now the end is near, and so I faced the final curtain, and in 5 hours, it was Sinatra's song. I'd never had a feeling like that in the completion of any kind of a song. And 2 months later, he called me in New York. He was in the studio in L.A. I'm in New York. He put the phone up to the speaker, and I heard My Way for the first time over the phone. And man, I started crying. It was
really
a movement. Yeah.
Because that song is seriously, it's like it has always existed. Like there couldn't have been a time without it.
Well, your songs are played everywhere. I mean, beyond My Way. Mm-hmm. We hear them in restaurants, department stores. They're part of life. You wrote the theme to The Tonight Show. Do you still feel pride when you encounter them in the wild?
Absolutely.
Does it seem momentous to you?
Very much so. Of course, it's the biggest charge you can get. It's the foundation of what I do, the performing I love to do, and I'm out there doing it. But the songwriting is the real backbone of what I'm about.
But you don't ever get weary? It's like, oh, man, again, really? She's a Lady?
You mean on stage?
I mean, well, anywhere. Like, if you know, I can imagine you picking up your laundry at the dry cleaners and hearing
and
that
hearing
song.
It?
Yeah, you know.
No, it paid for the trip to the dry cleaners. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
The gas today, I hear it, I'm going, oh, I can pay that check, you know.
Yeah. All right. Well, we've got a bunch of questions that our listeners sent in. They're very excited to hear the answers. You ready for this?
Yes.
Okay, we're going to start with Mark in Paris.
Wow.
Mark writes, I was surprised to learn you are a Canadian. Mm-hmm. How do you react when people assume you are an American?
I guess I'm very diplomatic, depending on where I am.
Just like a Canadian.
If I'm,
like a Canadian.
I'm in a war zone somewhere over in Europe. I'm a Canadian. But I have two passports. I have an American passport and proud to be here, and I'm a Canadian, and I'm very proud to be Canadian.
But if people say that you're an American, not knowing that you're a Canadian, you just let it pass, basically?
Well, I say I'm a Canadian-American. Or an American Canadian, or an Amicana, or a Canamalcama. I merge the words. You know, I'm a writer. I get them till they're dizzy.
Yeah. You say you're Canadian, you get free health care. So that's a bonus.
Never really wanted to go and stand in line for 8 months to get a wart taken off of my
All
nose.
Right. So that's when you use your American passport.
Exactly.
That's when you just pen a song to take care of the wart.
Well, I pay a lot of taxes down here, so.
That makes you an American, all right.
All right, well, we have another question.
Sure.
This one comes from Jeff in Lake Ozark, Missouri. And Jeff asks, do you correct people when you hear them singing the wrong words to your songs? Mm.
Oh, that's a very, very good question. I guess it depends on who it is. And when I was in Russia and I was singing for Putin and he was stumbling around with it, you don't correct Putin.
How did he butcher it? I want to know.
And now the end is Nirnanda. And so I'm been on Garkarton. Beautiful, beautiful.
Yes.
It depends. They mean well, and the fact that they're singing your song, yeah, go for it.
You know,
listen, I don't remember it half the time, so how can they?
So when you're at karaoke in L.A.?
Well, if some guy's going, put your legs on my shoulder. No, 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 wait.
I don't understand. What's wrong with that?
I think that somebody was me in fourth grade, actually.
Here's a question from Robbie in Los Angeles, speaking of L.A. karaoke. Robbie asked, one of my friends is a great guy, but I have a pet peeve. Mm. This guy is a veritable font of tired phrases. Should I let him know delicately that the way he expresses himself sometimes cheapens his thoughts? Or should I, to use one of his lines, let sleeping dogs lie?
Tough question, Robbie. You know, it all depends, man. It depends on the circumstances. I mean, obviously it's bothering you.
Yeah.
And if he's a buddy, you got to call him up on it, right?
Right.
So friends are for.
That's
another
what friends are for.
Song.
Yeah, there you go. You always hurt the one you love.
Did you ever do a sort of Cyrano de Bergerac and just sort of write lines for one of your friends? Just like, here, try this. This is going to be a little more sparkling in your conversation.
Yeah. If you were my friend, I would definitely be talking to you before I went out on a big date or something.
Right. You know, I could be on a mobile phone. You put one of those little earpieces in. I can walk you through it.
That's awesome.
I'll just have to show the person who I'm texting with. I think that might just work.
You think I have that kind of clout?
Well, it's like that Don Rickles story with Frank Sinatra.
Yeah.
They were at a club, and he kept asking Frank to come by and say hi to him and meet his date. And Frank was like, I don't want to meet your date. Don's like, come on. And then finally Frank comes over, he's like, hey, Frank, can't you see him with somebody?
I'm busy. Well, in my book, there's a great story because You know, Frank had heard that Don, you know, back in the Vegas days, because Don's a sweetheart of a man. I love Don Rickles.
Sure.
So Frank says, we're going to get him tonight, all in fun. And we go to the Sahara, 300 people. It's a lounge. Don is getting ready to come on. He sweats anyway, you know. And the big intro. Frank said to Jilly, who was his sidekick, he said, go get him now. He goes out. He comes back with about 12 L.A. Times. And I'm there with Dean Martin, Frank Sinatra, a group, all guys. We're sitting ringside. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Don Rickles. And Don comes out, and I know Sinatra's there, and the whole room knows. And Frank says, now, we all take our papers from under the table, open them up, and we start reading them while he's doing his act.
Did he have anything to say?
Oh, of course he had something to say.
Oh, yeah. He's like, you don't know how to read the insult comic, I'm sure.
You take it from there, right?
Paul Anka, thank you so much for coming here and telling our audience how to behave.
Is that what I did?
Unfortunately.
My God, I may be arrested in about a week.
You have your Canadian passport.
Put your head on my shoulder. Hold me in your arms, baby.
Singer and songwriter Paul Anka, his album Duets and his memoir My Way are both out now.
And people, if you are ever unsure about whether your way is the right way, send us a question. You can find us via our website, dinnerpartydownload.org.
Put your lips next to mine, dear. Won't you kiss me once, baby?
And now, time for Chattering Class. This is where we are schooled by an expert on some dinner party-worthy topic. We are just a couple of weeks into baseball season, so fittingly, our topic is baseball, and specifically the Major League's 1968 season. Our teacher is sports writer Tim Wendle. His new book is called Summer of 68, the season that changed baseball and America forever. And Tim, welcome.
Great to be with you, Rico.
Likewise. Thanks for coming. First of all, take us back to 1968. Paint us a picture of the social upheaval that was happening in that year.
Wow. I think my friend Hampton Sides may have summed it up the best. He said, that year was as close as we've come to a second civil war in this country. Mm-hmm. We had the assassinations of Dr. King, Bobby Kennedy, riots everywhere, pretty much culminating with the riots in Chicago in late August. And this is also where the Beatles start to break up, God forbid. And
that was the worst part.
That was the worst part, I think, for me, you know?
I'm kidding.
You knew it was the end when we hit Abbey Road, I guess.
But through all of this chaos, you follow the Detroit Tigers baseball season, and something I found gripping right off the bat is how all of these social issues actually affected the players so directly, because the draft is still on and some of these guys are serving in the reserves or in the National Guard. Can you tell us about the Tigers' Mickey Lawlich and the Detroit riots of 67? I found that amazing.
Well, Mickey was a pitcher for the Detroit Tigers. He was pitching one day. It was a doubleheader, pitched the first game, and then the riots began in Detroit. He was told, it's time you changed out of that baseball uniform. Your National Guard unit's coming into town, and you're going to be among the thousands of guard people patrolling downtown Detroit and trying to keep the city from erupting into flames.
The Tigers won the World Series in 1968, of course, but what else made them emblematic of that era? Why structure your book around that team?
Because I don't think any team has been under as much pressure starting a season than the Detroit Tigers were and when that season began. And the reason I say that is in a lot of ways, Detroit as a city, and you could argue it still is kind of the canary in the coal mine. Things are happening to that great city before maybe impacting the rest of the country. And when it happened in 67, that's when they had the worst rioting since the Civil War, and huge swaths of the city burned and really have never recovered. And the Tigers knew that, but they also were approached by local police, city officials, saying, it'd be really good if you guys won this year.
Yeah, right.
Because it might just hold this whole city together.
And no pressure.
Yeah, no pressure. You know, you guys kind of choked last year and the city went up in flames. Hey, don't do it again.
But now that said, though, the subtitle of your book straight up says that this season changed baseball, period. Not just this team or just that city. Mm-hmm. How is the sport different today because of that season?
I think the sport's different on a number of fronts. One being that there was a great deal of rule changes afterwards, Rico, because of the pitching. They felt the pitching was too strong.
It was known as the era of the pitcher because they had these were incredibly tight games.
Yeah, and you had incredible numbers that you will never see again. I mean, Bob Gibson with an earned run average of 1.12 for the season. Denny McClain with the Tigers winning 31 games. Nobody's really come close again.
Right. You could win a game easily by getting one run in that era.
Very much. And instead of kind of maybe embracing this to some extent, the powers that be in baseball got very skittish about it.
You want more hits, right?
Mm-hmm. You want more hits. And eventually ended up lowering the mound, shrinking the strike zone. We start getting kind of the real serious talk of a designated hitter, this type of thing, which all things that are kind of an anathema to some baseball purists.
That's it. And meanwhile, and this is, for me, I will confess, I'm more of a football fan than a baseball fan. I'm sorry, heresy.
No, that's but, fine.
I apologize to America. But in fact, you contend that 68 is the year that football begins to eclipse baseball as the national sport.
Very much. And football didn't even realize it. People have to remember this is well before, you know, very exact Nielsen ratings and all this type of thing. And it wasn't until they played a game between the New York Jets with Joe Namath and the Oakland Raiders, coached by John Madden, they ended up playing a game that came up to 7 o'clock on the East Coast, and they cut away from the game. They were contractually obligated to go to this made-for-TV movie, Heidi, yep, starring Julie Andrews' stepdaughter, which was terrible. And everybody went ballistic over it. The switchboard at 30 Rock, NBC, was carrying the game, almost melted down. They had to put a trailer on in the middle of Heidi, you know, saying what the final score was.
But what's amazing is that nobody expected this on the TV side. They didn't realize how many people were into football, basically.
No, and they didn't realize that there'd be a huge groundswell of protests going, where'd the football go?
Yeah, and not only where did the football go, but why? Not only are you not letting me watch the end of this game, which, by the way, ended with a kind of upset win, right?
Right, very much. The Raiders scored 2 touchdowns in the last 90 seconds, prompting the great quote from Joe Namath, always good for a quote, saying, I heard we lost, but I'm going to wait to see the replay. But, you know, people today, if they kind of gnash their teeth a little bit, maybe if they aren't football fans, and it's coming kind of late on a Sunday, and your local NFL team, they're holding up like 60 minutes or whatever the programming is next. It all is a result of this, because now all the contracts have to reflect the football game will be played and shown in its entirety.
Blame it on Heidi. So, Brendan, football gets to preempt everything, right?
Yeah.
So I was thinking that the public radio version of that would be membership drives.
That's true.
You know what I'm saying?
Which are kind of like football games, actually.
Yeah. Fewer broken limbs, though.
Well, it depends if people contribute.
That's right.
Get a late night visit from Nina Totenberg.
You don't want that, people. All right, ladies and gentlemen, so we've learned some manners and learned some baseball history, and now it's the part of the show where we get schooled by you, our listeners.
Yes, despite the giant Pope hats we wear in the studio, we know we are not infallible because you send us notes telling us that we made mistakes.
Yeah, it's a little annoying, but we deal with it. For instance, we did a story about how American food is the new trend in the UK, in which story I said I longed for a British invasion of one of my favorite dishes, the pasty. I mentioned pasties are just starting to catch on in the U.S. Well, it turns out they've actually been here for quite a while.
Hi, guys. This is Dawn. I'm calling from Michigan. Well, I'll tell you, if you want good pasties, come to Michigan. They're ubiquitous here. In the early 1860s, the Cornish mine workers came to work the copper mines in the Upper Peninsula, and they brought them along with them to have a little taste of home. And they became so popular that there is a little town that has a pasty festival every June. They're delicious. Come on up and get some.
Thanks, Don. Rico has blocked off the entire month of June.
Yeah, while I'm in Michigan, I would plan to quadruple in size. It's going to be crazy.
Another listener also took umbrage at some etiquette advice she heard on the show. It came from experts Lizzie Post and Daniel Post-Senning. They were asked how to respond to a sneeze in a multicultural setting when, God bless you, might seem inappropriate. Here's what they said.
You're pretty safe saying bless you to somebody who sneezed, whether or not you ascribe to a particular tradition or not.
I mean, sure, the rare disgruntled person might say, oh, I don't need your blessings.
How
to
dare
say,
you?
Say, sorry.
Turns out our listener Jan in Santa Barbara is one of those rare disgruntled people.
Actually, in some cultures, it's really inappropriate to respond at all to someone sneezing. It's like someone burping. You wouldn't draw attention to your friend who burped necessarily. Pretty ridiculous.
Thanks, Jan, for drawing attention to the omission.
I always thought you were supposed to high-five after a burp.
That's incorrect.
Lastly, we did a piece on the recent trend of draft cocktails. That is, cocktails pre-made in large quantities for easy serving.
Of course.
We wondered what could be next. Cocktails and juice boxes?
Ha ha ha, we said. Then our listener Adina blew our minds.
I'm calling from Seoul, South Korea. Well, actually, here in Seoul, they do have these little juice boxes. They have soju here in Korea, and they have sake in Japan. Sometimes I wonder if parents accidentally slip the wrong juice box into their kids' lunches in the mornings. That'd be pretty bad if they did.
Franzia, meet your maker. And just to prove that these boxes do exist, Adina generously pledged to mail us a few. Thank you.
So, the next time we mess something up on air, you can blame her.
Yeah. Email us via our website, dinnerpartydownload.org, and tell us what her boxes made us do.
And that's the Dinner Party Download for this week, folks. Jackson Musker is the assistant producer of our program. Tamika Adams, Davey Kim, and Brittany Martin are our interns. Peter Clowney is our executive producer.
Thanks also to Charlton Thorpe and Brendan Willard. If you like what you hear, head to iTunes and subscribe to our podcast. There you will find all of our past episodes for the price of free.
You can also hear from us for free by joining our Facebook page or following us on Twitter at Dinner Party DNLD.
Till next week, bon appetit.